Hello, and welcome to Conversations from the World of Allergy, a podcast produced by the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. I'm your host, Dave Stukas. I'm a board-certified allergist and immunologist and serve as a social media medical editor for the Academy. Our podcast series will use different formats to interview thought leaders from the world of allergy and immunology. This podcast is not intended to provide any individual medical advice to our listeners. We do hope that our conversations provide evidence-based information. Any questions pertaining to one's own health should always be discussed with their personal physician. The Find an Allergist search engine on the Academy website is a useful tool to locate a listing of board-certified allergists in your area. Finally, use of this audio program is subject to the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Terms of Use Agreement, which you can find at www.aaai.org. Today's edition of our Conversations from the World of Allergy podcast series is going to offer a wealth of knowledge pertinent for all healthcare professionals, as well as the general public. We are very happy to welcome back Dr. David Kahn to our episode to discuss the 2022 Drug Allergy Practice Parameters. Dr. Kahn is a professor of internal medicine and pediatrics at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, Texas, where he has served as the program director for the Allergy Immunology Training Program since 1988. I'm sure all of you are well aware that Dr. Kahn is the current president of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, and he's also the lead author on these parameters. He is one of the world's leading experts on drug allergy and the perfect person for today's discussion. Dr. Kahn, thank you so much for taking time to join us and welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Dave. It's a pleasure as always.
Yeah, we had you on last time to talk about penicillin allergy, and I have a feeling we're going to be touching upon that again. But let's start with, you know, the update to this practice parameter. The last published drug allergy practice parameter was in 2010, and I believe you were also involved in that publication. How is your role different for this new parameter?
Yeah, so it's quite a bit different. So the last time with the 2010 update, actually our roles were reversed in that, as you know, you were the task force liaison for the current one, and that was my role back in 2010. It was a little bit different process, and I ended up doing more work kind of on the back end of that. It wasn't as long as this process, as we'll talk about, I'm sure. But it was still, I enjoyed it. And we're looking forward to talking more about the current one as well.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, I am a member of the Joint Task Force, and I was involved as the liaison for this practice parameter. So I can attest to how much work you put into this. And I think it would be really helpful to take our listeners behind the scenes and describe the process involved in putting these parameters together. You know, for instance, when did the work group initially start working on this monumental task? And what was the general process to put this together?
Yeah, so as I was preparing, I guess, for this podcast, I was like, well, let me see exactly when we started this, because I was thinking like, well, it wasn't that long ago, was it? Well, it actually was. So the first recollection I had was from June of 2018. My files then show that in September of 2018, we started developing our individual sections. I think at that point, the Joint Task Force was a little bit backed up on different things. And then they provided a little bit of feedback. And then we started our, as you recall, our weekly Wednesday night calls in December of 2019. And believe it or not, I'm sure you do believe it, that went through October of 2021. Mm-hmm. So we had basically almost 2 years of nightly calls with this. And during this process, the Joint Task Force was reviewing sections as we were continuing to write. And eventually, we set a goal of having our first draft done by the February 2022 Academy meeting. Just before I assumed the presidency, I was like, okay, I want to get this off my plate. We made it, and I think you do owe me some drinks. My preference is Coke Zero, of course. And then it went out for review. It was revised, and then we had more calls and had to respond to about 300 different separate comments from the reviewers. And I'm delighted to say just a few weeks ago, August 30th, a mere 4 years later, it was accepted in JACI. So I'm thrilled.
Well, yeah, I think I appreciate that behind the scenes look. And as you stated, I was part of many of those calls and conversations. But for our listeners, That's 4 years from conception to publication for this practice parameter. So hopefully people can kind of keep that in mind as they read through all of the great information that's involved. Now, you were also previously a member of the Joint Task Force on Practice Parameters, and you've co-authored numerous practice parameters and clinical guidelines. I'm just curious, what keeps you coming back to the well time and again? I'm assuming there's some aspect of this arduous process that you enjoy or find rewarding.
Yeah, you know, it's as you know, being on the Joint Task Force, I think a labor of love is a good way to describe it. It's a lot of work. It's probably one of the hardest working, you know, things that I've done within the academy, maybe aside from the president, but still, it's a lot of work. But at the same time, you really get the sense of you're making meaningful differences for the specialty, that we're really developing these practice parameters and giving guidance for clinicians. And I learn a ton doing it, and I think it's hard work, but it's very needed work. And again, the feedback that you hear from clinicians about, yeah, you know, we find these parameters very valuable in our clinical practice, and that's so rewarding. But after a while, then it's like, well, I think it's time for some new blood. So after 15 years, I was like, I think someone else needs to take over my chair.
You get your evening conference calls back again a little bit, at least. And I'm sure you moved on to other conference calls. But, you know, the last update in 2010 was more comprehensive. And why did the Joint Task Force decide to go with a more focused parameter for this 2022 version?
Yeah, so we really looked at what was really different. And we didn't want to just go through things and say, you know, there really hasn't been a lot of changes here, because there are, I think, several sections in the old parameter that really honestly haven't changed that much. So we identified areas that we thought had changed pretty significantly and were worthy of doing an update. I honestly thought that this was going to be, you know, a 10 to 15 page document, and wouldn't really be that difficult. How naive I was.
Well, so this is not a 10 to 15 page document, and it comes in at over 180 pages with close to 600 references. And boy, I mean, it sure seems to be as comprehensive as it gets when it comes to drug allergy, at least at this, you know, current time. So in full disclosure and with no judgment whatsoever, have you yourself read every single word in this document?
So I have read the text. I promise you I've not read through all the 600 references. So hopefully we've gotten all those right.
Excellent. And as somebody involved in the editing process, I can attest that I have read every word at least three times. So thank you for all of the reviewer comments and all the edits that we had to put together. And yeah, it's a long one, but it's very helpful. And, you know, along those lines, it'd be impossible for us to discuss the entire parameter during today's conversation. And I'm guessing that most people won't have the time or stamina to really, you know, sit down and read this in one sitting. In your opinion, what's the best way for a practicing clinician to utilize this resource?
Yeah, you know, I think these parameters are not really meant to be read, you know, beginning to end. I know there are some people who do that, but I think a good way to tackle this one would be to sort of start at the beginning, because the way we kind of set this up was to really kind of highlight some of the new things that are in this. And then the executive summary, I think, isn't like super long, and that really is kind of the highlights page, if you will, for the parameter. And then obviously for those areas that you find as a clinician that this is something that is a big part of my practice, or I want it to be a bigger part of my practice, then you can certainly delve into that to your heart's content. But I think kind of reading, getting a good sense of what's in there, and then coming back to it certainly when there are areas that come up and it's like, well, you know, I was wondering about this certain specific aspect. It's always a good reference.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that's throughout not only this document, but other practice parameters are these consensus-based statements, which really they're in bold. They usually precede the section, which then goes into more detail in regards to what those are. And these kind of are very carefully worded. And can you just describe what these consensus-based statements are, how they're derived, and how they should be interpreted by readers?
Yeah, so I'd be happy to do that, Dave. But in fact, as you know, you wrote the section on the consensus-based statement. So I thought this might be a good opportunity for you to tell us what you wrote in the parameter. But yeah, I think this was a departure from our old parameter, but it's certainly the wave of the future. And I think it was a good approach for this document. So yeah, please. Take it away, Dave.
Oh my, the tables have been turned. So no, this is, I appreciate you asking me that. And here's what I take out of these. These consensus-based statements are evidence-based, and they are derived based upon a couple of things. The strength of the evidence that supports the statement and recommendation. And when there is a lack of evidence, that's also discussed as well, and that goes into it. But the other key part of this is that these are recommendations, and it's really important, I think, for listeners to understand when you read a consensus-based statement, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's not, you have to do this. It is, in these situations, this is what is likely going to be beneficial for the majority of patients that would, fit this description, and also the preference of the majority of patients. But there are other things to consider, such as, shared decision-making and whether that applies to specific situations and things like that. So that's why you'll have both the strength of the evidence or the certainty of the evidence, as well as the strength of the recommendation. And a lot of these are more conditional recommendations because, in medicine in general, there's very little that is purely black or white. So most of these address more of the tones of gray. So how'd I do with that?
Very well done. Very well done. Yeah. A plus. Yeah. So there, for those who are very close to this, we use wording very intentionally, and a lot of times that may not be obvious, but in these consensus-based statements, when we say we recommend, that's certainly like the strongest recommendation. And we find that that's the type of thing that, yeah, we feel like this is what, clinicians really should be doing in the majority of the time. The other circumstances are these more conditional recommendations where it's more of a suggestion, and we use the word we suggest. And there it's like, yeah, we think this is probably the right way to go, but, there may be other things that would go into that decision making. At the end of the day, these parameters are really kind of guidance, and they're interpreted as guidelines. But there are certain factors that only you as a clinician really knows that may cause deviation from this. But we do think that there's certainly changes that I think are, as we'll get into, that we think that the majority of people really should be doing and approaching certain aspects of drug allergy.
Your deep baritone voice is well suited for podcasting, and I'm getting the sense that you kind of want this gig after your presidency is up. Is that what's going on here right now?
Absolutely not. I'm in fact, last night I was telling my wife, I said I was doing the podcast, and she's like, "Oh, I didn't know you did these." And so I played a few, and she's like, "Those aren't very exciting." So she's like, "The podcast I listen to have all sorts of music and things like that, and they're much more entertaining than you are." I said, "Well, Dr. Stukas is really good at these, and he'll get the best out of me."
Well, I appreciate the feedback from your wife, and if she wants to make this into more of like a whodunit type of mystery podcast series, we can explore those options, I suppose. All right. So as we get into some of the meat of the parameters, and that's what we'll talk about for the last part of our podcast and our conversation today, can you offer some initial thoughts on how we should be classifying drug allergies and why this is important? This was specifically teased out at the beginning part of the parameters.
Yeah. So, I think this is still, this is honestly, I believe, still kind of a work in progress. Not to say that we shouldn't be doing this, but what's the best approach? So kind of the way that we sort of talk about classification of drug allergies. You can do it through a variety of different ways. You can think about the timing of the reaction. And in general, we think of drug reactions as being either immediate or delayed. And we say, well, an immediate reaction is within a few hours, and delayed reactions are, you know, maybe 6 or more hours later. And that helps us then understand what the potential mechanisms may be. And as we know, there are a variety of different potential mechanisms involved with drug allergy, ranging from IgE-mediated reactions to T-cell-mediated reactions to pseudoallergic reactions that are due to MRGPRX2 receptors, et cetera. And then we also do spend a little bit of time thinking about just the clinical phenotype and what we may learn from that. You know, is this just simple urticaria? Is it a morbilliform drug eruption? Is it a well-defined drug hypersensitivity reaction like SJSTEN or DRESS? So the more we kind of can nail this down really helps us then in terms of the approach, both in terms of, you know, diagnostically, management-wise, prognosis. So I think all of these features really kind of need to go into kind of classification of a drug allergy, but it's not as neat, I would say, as ideally you'd like it to be. And I think there's honestly still room for improvement in this aspect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but as you said, it, you know, just starting the process of being a little more thoughtful in regards to just the term allergy can mean so many different things, and it can affect prognosis and risk and things like that. And the other thing I really liked was how the initial pages, as you mentioned, that, you know, there's a section on what's new and different, the executive summary, and, you know, these parameters really spend a lot of space discussing a rather important paradigm shift in the evaluation and diagnosis of drug allergy, which sort of builds upon what you just mentioned in regards to thinking, being thoughtful about the classification of drug allergy. Can you discuss some of these critical areas and why such a focus was placed on this?
Yeah, so I think right up front, we talk about the real big change, I would say, stressed in this update compared to the previous drug allergy parameters. And that's really a de-emphasis on skin testing and more of an emphasis on doing challenges. So that's one thing, and we'll certainly kind of talk about that later, I'm sure. And then we talk about this kind of concept about risk stratification. And I would say, simply put, for a lot of things, especially like antibiotics, you really just kind of stratify, is this an anaphylactic reaction to an antibiotic or is it not? And when you kind of simplify things like that, it really does change the approach dramatically, especially as we get into kind of cross-reactivity between penicillin, cephalosporins, et cetera. And I'm sure we'll kind of talk about that down the road as well.
Yeah, and I was thinking as I put these questions together, you know, we sort of lived through with the reported reactions to COVID vaccines, which was occurring in real time as these drug allergy practice parameters were being put together. As you mentioned, this was a years-long process. And it's sort of a microcosm of what the parameters address, because there was so much skin testing early on. Skin test excipients and PEG and things like that. And then the evidence eventually sort of showed that, you know, the skin testing is probably a very limited utility, and it's more about a risk assessment and classification of allergy. Did you happen to, you know, notice that as well? I know you were involved in some of those studies and writing along those lines.
Yeah, absolutely. I think at the, you know, we honestly, I think, made some mistakes in our approach to COVID vaccination, you know, because it's all, you know, guessing a lot about what was going on with these reactions. Frankly, I think our assumptions were honestly flat out wrong. And now we know that the majority of people who have these immediate reactions to these vaccines can actually get the vaccines the second time and usually nothing happens. And that most of these reactions tend to be more anxiety and kind of what is referred to as kind of these immunization stress related responses versus any type of immunologic mediated reaction. So, it was something that I was always suspicious of, but it took time for us to really kind of figure that out. So, as everything COVID, it's a very steep learning curve. So it took us a bit of time to figure that out, but I think we're in a much better place of understanding that now. I think with drug allergy in general, we have forever accepted skin testing as our reference standard for diagnosis of and confirmation of an allergy. And when we think about it as an allergist, why do we accept a positive skin test as the gold standard when we don't do that for virtually any other allergic disease? I mean, if you just think about food allergy, we don't accept a positive skin test as saying that you're allergic to that food, because we know there are loads of people who have positive skin tests to foods, and it's clinically meaningless. So that's something that we as a discipline really need to kind of take on and not accept skin testing as our reference standard. And that's why I think drug challenges are really should be the reference, just like they are with food challenges in food allergy. This is something that the field needs to move towards. And I think with our current parameter update, that's really the direction that we went with.
Along those lines, and I'm glad you mentioned that, you know, we've all been taught this, right? As you mentioned, it's just been, you know, forever as we all go through our training as allergists, immunologists, skin test, skin test, skin test. So do you anticipate barriers in clinical practice for those who are used to skin testing whenever possible? And if so, how do we help our colleagues understand the concepts surrounding risk stratification and then the use of these drug challenges in their clinical practice?
I do think it's going to be hard. In fact, it was hard. It's been hard for myself. So thinking about, you know, penicillin skin testing, which we're just so used to, and we're like, you know, taught from infancy in our allergy fellowship that penicillin is the only drug that has validated skin testing. So why wouldn't you do it? And now we know that there are certain patients that really you probably don't need to do a penicillin skin test, and you can evaluate through a direct challenge, especially in kids. And this is something that it took me a long time to get more comfortable with for reasons that honestly don't make any that honestly, I would say the biggest reason that I was uncomfortable moving forward with that was I don't tend to be someone who really worries about getting sued a lot. But on this aspect, for some reason, I was like, well, you know, if some, you know, adverse thing happens and then, you know, I'm on the stand, they're going to say, well, Dr. Khan, don't you know about penicillin skin testing and isn't that shown, et cetera? And tell us what those guidelines that you have your name on, what did that say about, you know, the approach to this? And then you'd say, well, I don't have a leg to stand on, right? So now that we have these parameters that really then lend support and say, hey, for the first time, we're saying that it is okay to test people without skin testing. I think that is huge. And I think that gives that level of comfort saying that, sure, there's a lot of evidence, but now we have a bona fide practice parameter saying that this is okay in these circumstances to approach it that way. So I think this should be a big stress reliever that this is okay to do. I think it's going to take time though, because these are, you know, muscle memory almost as we're doing skin testing with all these people. But the reality is, as you start to do it, the more you do it, and you find that, gosh, this is a lot easier. You can delabel people quicker. It's going to be a huge benefit for practitioners. And a lot of clinicians oftentimes complain about, you know, the cost of doing drug allergy testing. I think this is. We know it actually reduces the cost, both the patient and also the provider. So I think this is a good thing.
And along the lines of, you know, trying to do more challenges when clinically appropriate, Should we routinely be performing multiple day oral challenges for the evaluation of penicillin or other drug allergies? And if not, when should this be a consideration?
Yeah, so this is something that we do actually have a recommendation against, the use of these multi-day challenges. You know, the thought process was, well, you know, you have these patients who have these kind of delayed reactions, and you're only going to pick that up if you do a prolonged, you know, 5 or 7 day challenge. And this is something that in the European guidelines have recommended for quite some time. But there are now several papers showing that a single day challenge, if you wait long enough, you can pick up these delayed reactions. So there's really no need to prolong the antibiotic. And in the eyes of antimicrobial stewardship, we certainly want to avoid unnecessary, you know, therapeutic courses of antibiotics when it's not necessary. So honestly, it's hard to kind of come up with a time when you would require, you know, a 5 or 7 day course of antibiotics when they don't need it as a challenge procedure to prove tolerance. I honestly don't think there's any role for that anymore.
Hmm. And when you talk about single day challenges, are we talking about a one-time dose of the full strength of a treatment dose, or should this be broken up into, you know, 2 steps or 5 steps, or what, you know, what are some of the considerations for that?
Yeah. So we talk about the steps of challenges and things like that in the parameter. And one of the things that we're really kind of highlighting is that you don't need to do, you know, what is oftentimes referred to as a multi-step. Multi-step would be probably more than two. So a one or two step challenge is actually appropriate in most circumstances. We honestly don't have any literature to say is doing 2 steps better than one, but we know that either way, it gets the job done. And essentially what we're talking about here, a 2-step challenge, for the most part, is that you give approximately a tenth of the dose of the therapeutic dose that you're accomplishing. And then, you know, sometime later, maybe 30 minutes or an hour later, or sometimes shorter, you can give the full dose and then observe afterwards. So it's a very straightforward way of doing that. And again, what we're talking about is when we're doing these drug challenges, we're doing them in patients that have been stratified to be low risk, where the pretest probability of them reacting is low. So we're not doing this in someone who had anaphylaxis, you know, 6 months ago and say, well, you know, let's see if you are allergic by giving you this test dose. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about, oh yeah, my mom told me I was allergic to this antibiotic, and now I'm 50 years old. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. You were a guest on our podcast almost exactly a year ago in episode 56, for those who are interested in listening. And that really focused on the importance of penicillin allergy delabeling. And this is also a point of emphasis in these parameters as well. Why was that included, and what should clinicians be doing to help with this?
Yeah, so we certainly, in fact, that's one of our recommendations, is this notion of doing proactive delabeling of penicillin allergy when it's appropriate. And I think most allergists now are aware that having that label of penicillin allergy is not benign. It's associated with a lot of adverse problems, not only for the patient, but also for the population at large. So it causes more increased costs. It increases the risk of patients staying in the hospital longer. There's even data showing that it increases mortality. And we know that very few patients who carry this label are actually allergic. So why not remove this harmful label? So I think this is sort of the challenge that I would actually throw down for us as allergists. And this concept of addressing patients who come into your office for other reasons. So they come into you for their rhinitis or for their asthma or whatnot, and you happen to notice that they've got penicillin allergy on their label, that's a perfect opportunity to have that conversation about delabeling. And in fact, this is something that we've been doing in our own practice, and in fact, it's one of our new metrics in our clinic to make sure that we're actually doing this. And I've been impressed with the, once you explain the downsides of carrying this label, how many patients will take you up on this? So I think it's a very worthwhile thing. And sometimes I see we get these referrals for patients that, you know, you're like, I know I can't help this patient. They shouldn't have been referred to me. And then I'll find out that they've got a penicillin allergy label. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, at least I can help with that. And I feel better that they haven't wasted their time seeing me.
I don't know if you've noticed this, but over the last couple of years, as we interview applicants for allergy immunology fellowship training programs, and you know, so these are typically third-year residents, a lot of them, their quality improvement projects are focused around penicillin allergy delabeling, which is amazing. And I think it's fantastic to see all these different residency programs across the country really focused on this. Have you noticed that as well?
Absolutely, yeah. It's terrific, and I'm glad that this message is kind of filtering down, and that these the future of our specialty is already getting involved in this even before they get into allergy. So I think it's terrific. Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's a very interesting observation.
Yeah. You've sort of touched upon this already, and this theme really permeates throughout the entire parameters, in my opinion. I get the sense that many suspected drug allergies are not true allergies, and clarification can occur through a standardized approach to taking a good history, knowledge of pathophysiology, and discussion of risk-benefit with each patient. Is it really that simple? And if so, why does this seem so difficult?
Yeah, the short is it honestly is that simple. I recall one patient who lived in, she came from San Antonio, which is about 5 hours from us. Mm-hmm. And for, you know, it was a straightforward penicillin allergy. And she came and I think this was in the era where we didn't have any penicillin skin testing, but the thing would be the same today. We literally just kind of gave her some amoxicillin in the office, and she's like, well, that was pretty easy. Why couldn't my doctor have done that? And I said, I don't know. So sometimes it honestly really is. And I think, you know, why does it seem so difficult? I think we tend to overthink and over worry about drug allergy. And I think, you know, as allergists, we learn about all the harmful things, and we're always worried about anaphylaxis and whatnot. But the reality is the vast majority of these patients really aren't allergic, and it's pretty easy doing this. I really do not lose sleep at all doing these type of procedures. In our clinic, you know, if I think about the reactions that I've seen in clinic, none of the concerning ones are related to doing drug challenges or things like that. It's immunotherapy. But mm-hmm. We all do immunotherapy. We don't worry about that. I've literally given epinephrine once in a patient for a drug challenge, whereas, you know, Not that I'm giving epinephrine shots on a weekly basis in our clinic, but it's not uncommon to do it for our immunotherapy patients. So, yeah, I think I don't know why the framing is so different, but we're so comfortable giving immunotherapy, yet you know the reactions that we do are so much more frequent, and drug challenges in the appropriate patients. And this is what we're talking about: risk stratification. It's a walk in the park, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. And somebody who deals only with pediatric patients, whenever I work with our fellows in training, I try to emphasize, instead of assuming that their reported allergy is real, let's assume the opposite and let's make them earn the diagnosis. And by the standardized approach, we can sort of go through this and figure this out for them. And it can make a huge difference in their life moving forward.
Absolutely. I like that. Earn the diagnosis.
What guidance is offered in the parameters regarding the evaluation of suspected non-penicillin antibiotic allergies?
Yeah, so We do talk about some other really important things, namely cephalosporins and sulfonamides. So I'm really excited about what we said about sulfonamide allergy, because I think this will be a true game changer for allergists. So I think most allergists are very uncomfortable with testing patients who have a history of sulfonamide allergy. I think we're all, you know, because sulfonamide antibiotics are bad actors. We know that they cause a lot of severe drug reactions. And, you know, we probably all have seen patients who've had severe drug reactions to sulfonamides. So I think that's the lens that we see these patients. But the reality is, you know, there's a lot of patients with you know, organ transplants, et cetera, that need sulfonamide antibiotics. And it's a safe way to for antimicrobial prophylaxis for these patients. So the literature, as we all know, is all about these kind of desensitization procedures, which is mostly based on HIV populations. And you know, it's all over the place. You know, do you do a 10-day procedure? Do you do a 6-hour one? And that was what was in the old the 2010 parameter. But when you actually look at the data, and we discussed this in, I wouldn't say gory detail, but in some detail in the parameter, actually there's been a few studies that look at comparing just doing a challenge versus one of these desensitizations, and it doesn't really make any difference. And now there are a few studies that have shown in largely non-HIV patients that doing a simple one step to a full strength, or in some cases a two-step challenge with the cotrimoxazole Bactrim, you can safely delabel patients. And again, it's the majority of patients that pass these tests. So I think this is something that we will have to get accepted to, get out of our comfort zone and say, hey, this is something that we want to delabel. Now again, this is a little different than proactively labeling everybody who comes in with a sulfonamide allergy. That's not what we're talking about. But when there's a need for it, it's something that we can do. And again, it's a simple way of doing this. Regarding cephalosporins, the one thing I want to say is that, again, as we've been taught in our infancy in medical school about the cross-reactivity between penicillin allergy and cephalosporins, and we had these various, algorithms in our 2010 parameter about how to approach this. And now it's very, very simple. And basically, if you have a penicillin allergy and it is not anaphylaxis, which is, probably 99% of the patients you see, and they need a cephalosporin, guess what? They can get any cephalosporin they want. And it makes it as simple as that. You don't need to test them at all. Now, what about that rare patient who comes in with penicillin allergy and it's legitimate, it's an anaphylactic penicillin allergy? They can get a cephalosporin with a disparate side chain. So, for example, they can get cefazolin preoperatively, and you don't need to test them. So this, I think, will be critically important. We really need to get the message out, not to allergists so much, but to hospitals and primary care, et cetera, so that they can treat patients more effectively. Not to say that we shouldn't be delabeling these patients. Maybe we can delabel them more at a leisurely outpatient basis, but it shouldn't interfere with their care in the hospital. So I'm really happy that we have these recommendations in place.
I've never heard somebody get so excited when talking about sulfonamides and cephalosporins, but that's why you're the right person for this conversation. Now, rightfully so, antibiotics are a main focus of these parameters, but there are other types of medication discussed in detail as well. What are the main recommendations surrounding the evaluation of suspected aspirin exacerbated respiratory disease?
Yeah, so I think the big point I would say with AERD is that we really emphasize how good the history is in making a diagnosis, and that you know, if you have a history of someone who ends up in the emergency room because of, you know, asthma after they've taken an NSAID and they've got nasal polyps, you can be very confident that they have AERD. It's a one-time story like that. So in reality, there's rarely a need to do any type of challenge in these patients. And essentially, that's what our recommendation is you don't need to challenge these people if the history is good. Now, there are some patients who, you know, have asthma and they have nasal polyps and they've avoided NSAIDs, you know, for the last 15 years. Well, then that's a person that may need to do some type of challenge procedure to figure that out. I would say the other thing that's been a little bit updated is we've provided some additional protocols and discussions about desensitization procedures for our AERD patients. So there is a little bit more in there about that as well.
What about other types of aspirin or NSAID-associated adverse reactions, such as patients who experience hives and swelling after taking these medications? Do these parameters contain any major updates for these concerns?
Yeah, we do. So for a lot of, you know, and again, I think one of the messages that we do talk about is the fact that, as you mentioned, a lot of patients who carry these labels of NSAID allergies aren't really allergic as well. And so one can perform challenges. And if you're, for these patients who come in with a, say, they get hives associated with ibuprofen, and maybe it's a one-time episode. So the question is this someone who is only sensitive to ibuprofen, which there is a phenotype that it's very selective, or is it someone who's going to react with hives to any type of NSAID? And how do you approach those patients? And our recommendation here is let's use aspirin to figure that out. And why did we pick aspirin? We actually picked aspirin specifically because, there is very little evidence that aspirin causes true anaphylaxis. We do know that NSAIDs properly can cause anaphylaxis rarely, really not aspirin. So we thought this is a very safe way to determine tolerance to other NSAIDs. And so that's actually a recommendation that we have in the new update.
A newer area surrounds the evaluation of suspected reactions to specific chemotherapeutic agents and biologic treatments. How can these patients be risk stratified to then help guide testing, avoidance, or other approaches to readministration of the offending agent?
Yeah, so this was an area that we did spend a lot of time discussing what the right approach is. And, you know, if you look in the literature is mainly talking about, well, let's take, for example, platin-containing chemotherapeutics that you can skin test for these platins. And there's evidence to say that, you know, this can actually help in your risk stratification and modification or management of these patients. But then when we kind of discussed this at a work group level, and in fact, within the joint task force as well, you know, how many allergists, immunologists are able to skin test for chemotherapeutics? Even in our center, this is something that we don't do often at all because it's very difficult and challenging, and there are regulations on who can handle these skin test things, et cetera. So while the literature is all about using skin testing to guide management, what about, you know, the 99% of the rest of the world where skin testing is really not a great option? Well, here now we say, okay, doesn't mean you can't do anything. In fact, you can manage patients, and depending on the chemotherapeutic that's used, depending on the reaction, we can risk stratify based on that information to determine whether, you know, maybe we want to slow the infusion, maybe we want to do a pre-medication, or maybe we want to what we refer to as an empiric desensitization for more severe reactions that we don't have confirmation that they're allergic based on skin testing, but the reaction was severe enough, the drug was suggestive that this is likely IgE mediated, and you can desensitize these patients without ever doing any skin testing. So there are ways of approaching these patients even without skin testing. We thought that was important to put in the parameter.
Absolutely. And we can direct our listeners to the full parameters for a more in-depth discussion of the specific chemotherapeutic and biologic agents. But are there any ones that you feel merit discussion here?
Yeah, I think what we really kind of focused on were the chemotherapeutics and biologics that as allergists, we tend to see reactions from the most. You know, as you know, there's a gazillion of them out there, but not all of them cause hypersensitivity reactions and don't really come across our doors. So as I mentioned, kind of we talk a lot about platins because platins, there's very good evidence that these are IgE-mediated reactions. And I would say that probably the most typical approach is to do a rapid drug desensitization. One of the things that we do discuss as an update is I think everyone's familiar with the three-bag rapid drug desensitization that was really kind of honed and refined by Mariana Castells. But it turns out that there's more evidence suggesting that a simple one bag, so you don't make any dilutions, you just use one bag, that may get the job done as well. So I think that's an option for people just to make things even a little bit more straightforward. Now, in contrast, taxanes, which are, you know, this would be this, you know, right up there in terms of referrals for chemotherapeutic reactions, these are typically not IgE-mediated. And here for these less severe reactions, slowing the infusion or pre-medication is appropriate. And then for those patients who do need rapid drug desensitizations, there's a pathway that if they do well, you may be able to transition them away from desensitization to just kind of a slowed infusion. So we talk about that. We have some algorithms in the parameter to discuss that. We also get into rituximab and how to approach that because that's a pretty common one that comes across our plate as allergists. So we really kind of highlight the ones as allergists that you're more likely to encounter and how you can manage these patients.
Mm-hmm. And as we kind of wrap up here, and we already talked about the fascinating phenomenon of evaluating patients with suspected hypersensitivity reactions to their COVID vaccines and how it really overlapped with, you know, some of the other teaching basically going on in these practice parameters. And these practice parameters don't delve into the literature surrounding COVID vaccines necessarily because of the timing of it and things like that. But there is some overlap in the section that's on excipients. And I would love for you just to take a moment to explain what are excipients and what role do they play in drug allergy?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And as you've kind of highlighted, nobody thought at all about excipients prior to the COVID vaccine in terms of like an allergy perspective. And suddenly excipients are, you know, at the front of everyone's minds in terms of, you know, allergy. So excipients are basically things that are added to pharmaceutical or in some cases food products and other things to help stabilize, et cetera. They're not part of the active pharmacology of the drug, but they're essentially additives, if you will. The main message that we stress in the parameter is that excipient allergy is very rare, and I don't think that can be stressed enough. But you know, when should you think about excipient allergy? And that would be in patients who have what I would call bona fide anaphylaxis. This is like legit anaphylaxis, and it's two disparate drugs. So they're completely different, but there is a common thread here, and it's like, oh yeah, they have this same excipient. That's someone you could think about. And the classic examples are injectable corticosteroids and then PEG-based laxatives. So again, I don't think we need to be thinking about excipient allergy all the time. In fact, I was real excited that I was going to have my first case of PEG excipient allergy in a woman who came to me who had legitimate anaphylaxis to a couple different products that contained contained PEG. I'm like, this is a great story. We tested her. She was not allergic to PEG. Turned out she had mastocytosis, so I'm still waiting for my first excipient allergy patient.
Where can our listeners find the full published drug allergy, a 2022 practice parameter update? And are there any accompanying slides or other materials to help those of our colleagues who are interested in educating others about these updates?
Yeah, so pretty soon, the parameter should be available on Jackie in its kind of, I would use maybe in quotations, its ugly form. It's not too pretty. We have not yet seen the galleys, but my anticipation would be probably in the next month or so, hopefully the full update will be in all its glory and Jackie online. So we're excited about that. And then in terms of the slides, fortunately on this conversation, we have the person who put together the slides, Dr. Stukas. So, I can say Dave did a terrific job putting together a slide set that, how do you encompass a slide set for such a large parameter? I think he did a terrific, I should say he, you did a terrific job putting this together. So kudos to you, Dave. And honestly, you can maybe tell me, because I'm not sure where to find those.
Yeah, so they're going to be on the Practice Parameter website for sure. And I don't know, I'm sure the Academy will have some link to them as well. And then for our listeners who may be catching this, you know, down the road in December or January, whenever it may be, we will definitely put a link to the full drug allergy practice parameters on the webpage where you access this podcast. So you can go to the Academy's website and look up the podcast and you'll get a direct link right to it. So there'll be multiple different ways to find this information. And thank you very much for your kind words. I didn't plant that question to hear you say that, but no, but really the goal is, and you touched upon this, and it's so important, it's one thing for us as allergists, immunologists to read this and understand it and apply it to the patients that we see. But we all, firmly believe, especially on the Joint Task Force, we want to spread the word. And I think that we want to give materials like this slide deck to make it easy for anybody to give presentations to their, their colleagues in the community or at your own institution and things along those lines. So by all means, that's why they're there. Feel free to use them as you see fit.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, just yesterday I was giving a grand rounds to obstetricians, and I threw in a bunch of our consensus-based statements, and they were very appreciative.
Yeah, right. Surgeons, obstetricians, those in primary care, pharmacists. I mean, there's so many people that need to understand where the evidence lies right now and what these recommendations are. We've covered a lot of ground with today's conversation, and I encourage anyone who's interested to really take your time and read through the parameters on your own. If you're having trouble sleeping at night, that's a great way to kind of doze off a little bit as you try to tackle the behemoth, and you can dive into some of the details on this. Do you think that we missed anything major during today's conversation, or is there anything else that we should discuss?
Well, Dave, I've been meaning to mention to you as Joint Task Force liaison that we do need to start scheduling our weekly calls, because we got to start working on the update again already, because this is a multi-year process. We better get started, right? No, I think we've covered a lot of the key aspects in this. The real big things that I think are truly practice changing. I'm real excited that this is finally seeing the light of day. It's been a long process, but I think we're pretty proud of the ultimate product.
Well, as we wrap up here, and I really can't thank you enough for taking the time to spend with us and discuss all of these things. What's next for you? Are you on to the next clinical guideline or practice parameter, or is your focus elsewhere now that you're about halfway through your term as the Academy president?
Yeah, so no parameters in the future for me, hopefully, for a while. I think, as you kind of mentioned, one of my main focuses will be to get the word out about the parameter and to every audience honestly, I think every medical audience is appropriate for this. So I will actually be presenting at my presidential plenary in San Antonio about the updated parameters. So I'm looking forward to doing that.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was just thinking that I'm sure the speaking invitations have gone out for the Academy annual meeting already. And I have no doubt that drug allergy will be on the docket this year.
It will.
Dr. Khan, this has been a very useful conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time. Do you have any last words before we depart?
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't remind everybody that in 19 days, another important holiday is coming up, National Penicillin Allergy Day. And I thought I would share with you a kind of a interesting story that relates to this. It'll sound like, where is he going with this? But there's a point to it. So Kristen Alvarez is the pharmacist who really kind of came up with the great idea to have a pharmacist-led inpatient penicillin allergy labeling program at our county hospital, Parkland. And we've been doing this since 2014. It's been terrific. So she had mentioned to me that she was getting some landscape lighting done at her house. And, you know, she was like looking at the guy who was doing this, and the contractor's name was Fleming. She's like, oh, that's kind of interesting. You know, I know of a Fleming. And he's like, yeah, I'm related to that guy. So there is Fleming has come to Dallas. So no, he's not doing penicillin allergy, but I thought that was really karma.
That's very cool. And then September 28th is the day. Is that the same date every year? Is it National Penicillin Allergy Awareness Day?
It is, yeah. So you can set that as a reminder in your calendar forever.
Yeah. Are there parades? Are there floats that we should be looking for, or anything along those lines?
We will work on that. But the Academy is going to be doing a lot of different things around Penicillin Allergy Day. So stay tuned for more emails, et cetera. But yeah, I think a parade may be in the works. We'll have to think about this next year.
Well, thank you again for joining us.
My pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed listening to today's episode. Please visit www.aaaai.org for show notes and any pertinent links from today's conversation. If you like the show, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify so you can receive new episodes in the future. Thank you again for listening.